Possible in part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign. The staff at The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting WILL AM 580.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Historian Gary Nash says we tend to remember the American Revolution mostly in its enshrined mythic form. We tend to see it as a noble and inspiring David and Goliath story. But Nash says it's more complicated and more interesting than that. This afternoon, we'll hear about the people we likely didn't hear about in our history classes or read about in our history textbooks. Gary Nash says these people, not the men of marble, did most of the protesting, most of the fighting, most of the dying, and most of the dreaming about how a victorious America might satisfy the yearnings of all its people. Gary Nash is our guest this afternoon. His latest book is The Unknown American Revolution, The Unruly Birth of Democracy, and The Struggle to Create America. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion with a telephone call. I look forward to your questions and comments. Here are the phone numbers. If you're in the Champaign-Urbana area, the number is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. If you're outside the local dialing area, use the toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Our guest, Gary Nash, is professor of history and director of the National Center for History in the Schools at UCLA. He has written and edited more than 20 books. He's a former president of the Organization of American Historians and an elected member of several academic societies, including the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. His latest book, The Unknown American Revolution, The Unruly Birth of Democracy and the Struggle to Create America, is published by Viking. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Professor Nash, thanks so much for joining me this afternoon.
Well, good afternoon, Celeste. Pleasure to be with you.
Yeah. Why do you think we have lost sight of the ordinary people who contributed so much to the revolution, and we became so focused on those men of marble?
Well, history must have its heroes. Every nation must have its heroes. And I suppose it's not unusual in this country that we know the most about the people who got chiseled into marble and ended up in our national pantheon. So it's not that we're unique in this, but in most complicated revolutions, and almost all of them are complicated, there are a great many people involved, and it takes a great diversity of people really to make a revolution work.
Mm. You say that the American Revolution was a truly radical, world-shaking event. What do you mean when you use that term, radical and radicalism?
Well, I mean by radical a sharp transformation of a society, a sharp shift in direction, an attempt really to remake a society, to fashion it along different lines, and usually it means along more liberal or progressive lines. Liberal and progressive meaning attention to the people who are the downtrodden or the dispossessed.
Hmm. Now, one of the first interesting characters we meet in the book is not an American patriot. He's an Anglican minister who's worried about this great religious foment of 1740, the Great Awakening. He was the uncle, however, of a future patriot, a radical, then just a boy, Patrick Henry. Why was the minister railing against the Great Awakening?
The Great Awakening was an upheaval, not just a religious upheaval, therefore we call it the Awakening, but a social upheaval as well. If you were to go through Patrick Henry, the uncle's Virginia and seen these untrained, self-appointed people claiming that they had spiritual gifts and a message to say, and went around the country speaking in forests and in river bottoms and so on. You might imagine then that the people who held most of the power and who ran the colony would be disturbed at these upstarts. The whole idea that they could claim to speak in religious terms to ordinary people seemed to be turning their world upside down.
Yeah. Well, what did the Christian conservatives do to try and quash them?
They ran the gamut from trying to drive them away from their pulpits, even if they had one. It might even be standing in an open field, imprisoning them, fine them, describing them as heretics, even as treasonous. So it was a day when they went to great ends to try to keep a lid on the pot when they saw the pot boiling.
Mm. To what extent did the Great Awakening provide a foundation, some grounding for the revolution that lay ahead?
A friend of mine, a wonderful historian, Pat Bonamy, describes the Great Awakening as a rehearsal for revolution, a rehearsal in that ordinary people found a voice of their own in the Great Awakening. They learned to challenge authority. They learned to conceive of a different world than they were told to imagine. And from the Great Awakening, then, there builds a kind of spirit, a kind of audaciousness when it comes to challenging authority. And it could lap over then from the religious realm to the political realm.
Mm. Well, we go from this Anglican minister, an uncle of Patrick Henry, to Patrick Henry, one of the well-known figures of the Revolution. What set him on course to become a radical?
He was from the western frontier of Virginia, not so very far from where Jefferson was building Monticello, or would be building Monticello shortly. And it was a frontier society where there was a much rougher kind of equality than in the Tidewater areas of Virginia and Maryland, dominated by large slave owners and large landowners. So Patrick Henry did grow up in a rough and tumble part of Virginia. And this is the kind of country where evangelical Baptists and Methodist preachers had their greatest effect. They reached out to people and they imagined a more equal society.
Yeah. Well, the Great Awakening wasn't the only religious, what would you call it, movement of the last half of the 18th century. There was also a Baptist religious revolution in the 1760s. What was that about?
Yes, the Baptists were also a people that gathered their flocks mostly from the lowly, from the poor, or the very ordinary people, and they preached a much more egalitarian kind of religion. They went back to the Bible, and they thought of themselves as the true people of God. Jesus is poor. And so they, in their religious notions of equality, that every man is equal in God's sight, they could move over, slip over toward the political realm, where they found concentrations of political power objectionable and oppressive.
Mm. So to the Quakers.
Quakers were quite different. They were very egalitarian in their religious society of friends. They gave women a much larger role in Quaker affairs than would people in other denominations. In fact, Quaker women were allowed to preach and were encouraged to preach. So that set them off very sharply from almost every other religious group in America. But in politics, they tended to be much more conservative, at least by the time of the Revolution. And then the enormous matter for them to wrestle with and for the rest of the society around them to cope with was that the Quakers were pacifists. They were, by belief, unwilling and unable to shoulder a gun, to use violence against fellow human beings. So when the war came, it put them in a very difficult crunch.
What role did they play in this time of the march toward revolution in terms of the discussion of slavery?
Well, that's a good question, Celeste. They were very much the vanguard of abolitionism. They were the first, really, to cry out against slavery, to regard it as a moral defect, as inhumane, and because they had participated in slave trading and slave owning, they made it their business to cleanse their own religious society from slave keeping, as they called it. And so by 1775, the Quakers, led by the leaders in Philadelphia, had decided that they really must get rid of slavery. And the word went out then, you can't be a Quaker and a slave owner at the same time. Now you must make your choice.
Hmm. What role did they play in continuing to foster that discussion, this argument, after the Revolution?
As to slavery?
Yeah.
Well, they continued. They founded the first abolition society in the Western world, founded within a few weeks of the firefight at Concord Bridge and at Lexington. And after the Revolution was over, they really built their Pennsylvania Abolition Society and took a leading role in trying to get Congress and the national government under the Constitution, ratified in 1788, to consider whether a society could really be built in America, whether we could be a united people, and whether we could be a republic if a fifth of the population was held in slavery. So they were the ones who pushed the issue. They lost most of their battles, but they kept the flame alive.
Hmm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Historian Gary Nash is our guest today here on the program. His latest book, The Unknown American Revolution, The Unruly Birth of Democracy and the Struggle to Create America. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. We welcome your participation. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL. 800-222-WILL. In addition to the Quakers and their turn away from slavery and toward abolition in the 1750s, the Great Awakening of the decade before, the Baptist religious revolution of the 60s, were there other things underway? Were there other great social movements that helped light the fuse for the revolution?
Yes, there were many in the cities. There were tradesmen, we would call them artisans or craftsmen we would call them today, were pushing for a larger role within the political councils at the local level or the state level. And in the frontier areas, there were tremendous disputes over land and particularly great dissatisfaction with the role of tenant farmers. There were huge tracts of Hudson River land and backcountry North and South Carolina land that were held by a small number of people. And to those large landowners, a mass of ordinary farmers were beholden. So there was a constant tension running through colonial society between the haves and the have-nots, the large and the small. And the terms under which land could be held or land could be gained.
Yeah, so we have a tension between because of the gap between the classes. I've got a caller here who's waiting to talk with us, but before I get to that call, I'd like you to tell us something about the North Carolina regulators.
Yes, the North Carolina regulators have slipped from our history memory bank in large part. The North Carolinians still know about it, but the regulators were ordinary people led by some very interesting and fiery characters, one named Herman Husband, who you won't find in many of the history books, but they were ones who wanted to stop a system which they felt was stacked against them. The large landowners controlled the courts. They controlled the way land was distributed. They exacted taxes unfairly from those who could afford them the least. And it reached a point by the 1760s in North Carolina where these ordinary frontier farmers were willing to take up arms and settle this, if need be, by force.
Let's talk with the listener now. Caller in Eureka on line 4. Hi.
Hi. Very interesting. This week, last weekend on Book TV, I listened in on an author whose main point was that the Americans really didn't have it that bad, and he gave several reasons. One, the amount that the British government spent on garrisoning troops to protect settlers on the frontier. And secondly, he said the tax burden on the American colonists were really much less than on those of, say, British subjects. Could you comment on that, please?
Yes, sir. Well, I think that is correct, that the tax burden was not that great. The Americans were pretty lightly taxed, and so we have to search for a reason why fairly small taxes, the tax on newspapers or wills or playing cards, known as the Stamp Act, why would they get so disturbed about this? So if it was not the heaviness of the tax burden, it was more really whether any kind of tax was appropriate if the Americans had no representation in Parliament.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Well, back to the North Carolina regulators. Were there groups like them, farmers like them in other parts of the colonies who had the same grievances?
Yes, there were. In New York, very notably, and also in other colonies in Vermont, and also in South Carolina. So there is a thread of rural radicalism, a desire for sharp change that is running through the late colonial period and feeds into this revolutionary consciousness that is building in the 1760s and 70s.
And in the cities, what's going on?
Well, the cities are not what we think of today. Philadelphia, the largest, wouldn't have as many people as you would find at Disneyland on an ordinary Tuesday afternoon. So we're speaking of really overgrown seaport villages, 20 to 30,000, Boston, New York, Philadelphia, and Charleston being the largest. But in these cities, there is a growing gap between wealthy merchants, urban landowners, lawyers on the one hand, and then the urban poor. And there is a growing thread streaking through the life of these cities, too, leading up to the Revolution, where the haves and the have-nots are imagining a different America. At the same time, they're thinking about whether America shouldn't be independent. It's this imagining of different communities, a different kind of America, that I think is so fascinating about the American Revolution. We really have to set aside the notion that it's simply a war for independence. That it certainly is. But simultaneously, it's a struggle to recreate America if the British should be defeated.
And simultaneously, all these different groups of people are having their own vision of what we should be. Correct?
That is right. And I love the phrase of Thomas Paine, who said, "Can America be happy, as happy as she wishes? She has a blank sheet to write upon." And that was true. By declaring independence, they wiped out English law. They wiped out the charters under which they lived as British colonists. And so now, having wiped the slate clean, something new had to be put on it. And people sprang forward, people of many different kinds, with different agendas for the future, who wanted to inscribe on this blank sheet. And those blank sheets turned into so many state constitutions and so many bodies of laws that had to be created afresh at the point of independence.
When the smoke began to clear at the turn of the century, as we move from the 18th into the 19th century, how did Thomas Paine view the Revolution then?
Well, he went away after the Revolution, off to England first, where he wrote two bombshell books, The Rights of Man and The Age of Reason, which got him into great trouble. He fled to France, found himself in the middle of the French Revolution, and then somewhat later came back at the turn of the century, by the time Jefferson is in the White House, to America. And he did look back. I talk at the end of the book about how he looked back at what had happened over a quarter of a century. And he wrote a series of essays, and he loved this phrase, sparks from the altar of 76. He wasn't altogether happy with what he saw about how the revolution turned out. He thought much had been accomplished, but he thought that much of the promise of the revolution was still unfulfilled.
Hmm. How did others view the revolution? Did they see it in a similar light? From the founders to those who took up arms and who have largely been lost to us, who are anonymous. I mean, those people have largely disappeared, but those people we do have a record of, other than the founders. What kinds of things did people talk about, you know, as the smoke was clearing?
Well, I try to see this. The book is really organized around trying to see the revolution through the eyes of different sets of people. So I might answer your question by saying, well, what did women think mm-hmm. about the revolution as they look back on it? Or how the daughters of the revolutionary era, how did they look back on it? And the same, can we see the revolution through the eyes of African Americans who made up 20% of the population? So I try to move from group to group. Now, for Black Americans, those who were still enslaved at the end of the war, and that is to say most of them, it was a great disappointment because they did hope that the revolution would be the dawning of a new era for them. For American women, some things were accomplished, but by and large, the agenda for change was one that, if not put on the shelf, had to be pursued. And it would take a long, long time. Well, let's think of how long it took until 1920 for women mm-hmm. to get the vote. Yet that was on the agenda in the Revolutionary era, and in the state of New Jersey gave women the vote in 1776. So different agendas and different expectations and different degrees of disappointment or satisfaction as to how the revolution turned out.
Yeah. Let's talk about some of the individuals that you write about in each of these groups. Maybe you could talk about Sarah Osborne.
Oh, yes. Well, I think she's probably lost to history for most people, but she was a very strong-minded and highly intelligent woman in Newport, Rhode Island, and she was very interested in the Black people of Newport. They were numerous. Newport was a slave trading center. And she wanted to find a way to educate free and enslaved young Black men and women. So that, for her, was part of being a religious community. And she knew Phyllis Wheatley, the Black poet, mm-hmm. the young woman who wrote such beautiful poetry. And Sarah Osborne, though she never had much power in the community itself, had considerable power within her own church. She and other women had a real voice when it came time to find a new minister, when an old minister died or retired or went to another location. So Sarah Osborne is one of those women who's more or less hidden in the shadows. But the more we look at her, the more interesting she is, and the more we know that she's an important part of the Newport community.
Yeah. You mentioned Phyllis Wheatley. There's another fascinating woman.
Yes, the young girl brought from Africa, almost shorn of clothes, at age 7 or 8, and yet had mastered the English language and could read the Bible from beginning to end, was writing published poetry when she entered her teenage years. So she was a remarkable figure. Her life was very short. She died I think she was only about 30, 31 when she died, but she left us evidence of an extraordinary young African mind and a living refutation of the notion that Africans were by birth or by nature inherently inferior.
Mm. This is something so wonderful to contemplate. Here's the first woman in North America writing in a political vein. Those poems were quite political.
Yes, she was a patriot. She wrote an ode to Washington. She wrote poems critical of British policies in America, British oppression, British tyranny, she would use the word. And then she would very gently slip over into undertones of dissatisfaction or even outrage against African slavery itself. But yes, it's just quite remarkable, this young slave in Boston, writing slaves that are published in London in 1773 while she's still a teenager.
Mm.
Truly remarkable.
What were her owners, John and Susanna Wheatley, like? Do we know anything of them?
They supported it. They saw a genius there, a spark of genius. And their daughter worked with Phyllis, teaching her to write. Her master and mistress encouraged her, and they helped her get to England, actually to visit England, where she had a patroness, I would say, a wealthy woman, very interested in this young African's poetry. So Phyllis crossed the Atlantic, met with a Countess of Huntington, who subsidized the publication of Phyllis Wheatley's poems, and then back to Boston comes Phyllis to be freed by her master and her mistress.
Hmm. What was the appetite for political debate, for political knowledge in the colonies in the second half of the 18th century?
The colonies were perhaps the most literate part of the Western world, or perhaps the world overall. Particularly in New England, a little less so in the middle colonies, Pennsylvania, New York, New Jersey, less so in the South. And, of course, we're speaking of white literacy because slaves were ordinarily not permitted to learn how to read or write. But the literacy level was very, very high. And, therefore, the thirst for books and the printed word was great. So the colonies were a great place to be publishing pamphlets, reading newspapers, spreading the word when you're trying to build a revolutionary movement.
Hmm. How common was the pamphlet, the broadside, the newspaper?
Well, a newspaper, there were many of them in the colonies, and they were growing in number rapidly as the revolution approached. And then the simple broadside, it might be a one-pager tacked to a lamppost or a tavern door, could be very widely read. And when Tom Paine's Common Sense comes off the press in January of 1776, it was a thunderbolt, and it spread, the word of it spread so rapidly that it became the most widely read book in America other than the Bible. It just sold an astounding number of copies. It would make a king rich under today's public royalty rates, but Paine didn't make any money from it. But it had an extraordinary reach.
Mm. The white colonists, how many were able to read and write?
Well, probably at least half of all the white colonists, and in New England it would reach almost three-quarters of the adults. Almost all the young people learned to read and write because reading the Bible was such an important part of community life in these New England towns. But 50 to 75%, extraordinarily high for the 18th century.
Hmm. I'm thinking now, and correct me if I'm wrong, but a labor organization in Boston was responsible for the first circulating library in North America. How many books did they have, and What kinds of books did they own?
It would be a small library. It would fit nicely into quite a small room, several hundred volumes. But these lending libraries, which were coming into vogue as we approached the Revolutionary years, were a way for young people and often craftsmen to get together and discuss ideas. Benjamin Franklin formed a library, the Library Company of Philadelphia, very early on, and it became an important part of community life for these young working men. Hmm. They would read English books. They would read Daniel Defoe. They might read Milton, and they would read Shakespeare. So they were pretty well educated working people. And they would read political tracts. They would read political writers. Or they would read the works of people like Rousseau and Voltaire and Montesquieu of the Enlightenment.
Yeah. Was there anything like a circulating library for working people in Europe?
There may have been one in London, but I'm not very sure about that. But the colonies, I think, were in advance of most of the European nations in terms of the access to books that ordinary people would have, newspapers or books.
Hmm. You know, the people that you portray here in the Unknown American Revolution, was it difficult to find them, to flesh them out? Would you maybe talk about the source material you drew on?
Oh, well, I love to prowl in the archives, and that's been the pleasure of my life. I think of myself walking through the history cemeteries looking for overturned tombstones where the writing has all but been rubbed out, and seeing if we can't find out who lies beneath that old, worn-out tombstone. And the sources are many, and they're various, but they can be found in all sorts of unexpected ways. The tax lists are a kind of group portrait of a city, because each taxpayer on, let's say, a Philadelphia or a Boston tax list is named by occupation. The number of slaves or servants in the family would be noted, the amount of land that was owned, the size of the house. All of this is wonderful data to try to paint a collective portrait of a community. Hmm. As for bringing the life of an individual alive, one has to work as a social historian with bits and scraps. But it's surprising, though, if you dig in hard and look at some of the old sources that have been around, that you can extract much more than at one point we might have imagined some years ago. So I think in one of the great pleasures of being a historian over the last three or four decades has been to see how women, African-American historians, and others have been able to piece together fragments of history to bring to life people that we knew much too little about.
Yeah. Do many of the pamphlets, the broadsides of the era, survive?
Oh, yes, they do. Yeah. And in this new electronic data retrieval world, a great portion of everything that was printed in the 1700s can be viewed at home on your computer screen. All the early newspapers are available. All the early broadsides and pamphlets that have been collected over the years have been digitalized and are available on computer. So we have this tremendous opening up of access to the documents of the past. It's a great democratization of sources.
Mm. So I could go online and conceivably I could read the rights of the British colonies asserted and proved.
Yes, you could. Yes, you can find anything printed. From the first printing press in Cambridge in 1638, if I have the date right, right on through to the age of Jefferson. So we're talking about tens of thousands of of printed pieces from the individual leaflet and broadside to a published sermon or to the debates of a colonial legislature.
Hmm.
It's marvelous.
Yeah. On the other hand, it's got to be tougher to reconstruct the lives of African Americans and American Indians.
Yes, they are difficult because African Americans, most of them, the vast majority of them, not having acquired the ability to write, have left us very little in their own words. There were a dozen or so who wrote, who did learn to read and write, and wrote memoirs of their revolutionary experiences. So we have roughly a dozen of these, and they're very interesting. But we have to then let the actions of African Americans speak for what was in their minds. We have to make their feet speak to us. We can observe what they did, what actions they took. And the big story in the American Revolution is they fled their masters to join the British Army because the British offered them freedom. So they made their own declarations of independence, if not in writing, by the way they fled to the British to gain their freedom.
Hmm. Yeah, that's interesting to realize that, waiting for African Americans to wait for appeals to conscience, they can't do it. They have to push forward. They have to go beyond that.
They did, and the revolution became the great moment of opportunity for them. The appeals to conscience led by the Quakers and other New England ministers and even some of the Southern leaders fell on deaf ears for the most part. But when the British Army offered immediate freedom, it was sensible, logical, almost predictable that thousands of slaves would not wait for the uncertain possibility that the appeal to conscience would work. Someday, some month, some year, somewhere down the line, but here the British come with an immediate offer of instant freedom.
Hmm. What about American Indians? There's one in particular I'm thinking of, very fascinating man, a Delaware Indian by the name of Neolin.
Yes, Neolin was a young person in the late colonial period who had a vision, and the vision that came to him was that his people would have to learn to recapture the old ways, the old Indian ways. They would have to give up a dependence on European guns, on European woven textile goods. They would have to give up the use of European distilled alcohol. They would have to return to the old ways. And if not, their destiny was not a good one. The future would be bleak. And so Neolin tried to lead his people in a new direction. He incorporated some Christian ideas. They appear in this vision as well. But he and then many other Indian leaders of the revolutionary period are trying to think about how they can reverse the course of history, because for a century and a half, they had seen their land disappear from them. They had seen their relations with the white colonists deteriorate. And the revolution, as for the African Americans, became a time when perhaps a big change was possible.
Hmm. What impact did he have on other Indian nations besides his own, the Delaware?
Well, his reach was probably pretty limited, but he would be followed by others, by the Shawnee prophet. And in every Indian society, and there were a great many Indian nations east of the Mississippi River, leaders emerged in the revolutionary period to try to think about how they were going to somehow make the right choices so that this war between what they called a family squabble between the English and their children, the colonists, how they could make this work to their advantage. It was a great time of troubles for Indians. They would prefer not to be involved in this fight between the British colonists and the mother country. But they were pushed by both sides, both the British and the Americans, to enter the war. And when they did, they entered usually on the British side because they saw that the British protecting their land was more likely to happen than when the Americans won. The Americans would come westward and grasp for that land as they'd been grasping for it for a long time.
Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Urbana on line one. Hi.
Hi, Dr. Nash. It's a pleasure, sir. I trust that you have read Christopher Hitchens' biography or mini-biography of Jefferson, and I'm sort of curious as to what your criticism of that may be. You may not have, but I'd be surprised. And the other question that I have is, what is the influence, and this is a bit of a digression, the influence of the Quakers, since you mentioned them earlier on the formation of early American rural socialisms, the Fourierists, the Owenites, New Harmony, etc. And thank you for accepting my call.
Well, my pleasure. Now, I have to step back from the Hitchens book because, in fact, I haven't read it. I'm staring at five shelves of books. I'm speaking from my study at my home, five shelves of books on Jefferson. And there's a new biography every 6 months, as far as I can tell, on Jefferson. So I'm still playing catch-up. I've read perhaps a dozen books published in the last 5 years on Jefferson, but I'm one behind on Hitchens, Christopher Hitchens, yes.
Yeah, yeah. And his other question about the impact of the Quakers, or did they have an impact in terms of the utopian societies, the other kinds of progressive organizations or societies that were built?
Well, I don't think the Quakers were so much involved in the utopian communities as the Shakers. The Shakers, led by a woman, Lee, who had very communalistic forms of gathering themselves together. And they were also celibate, so that they did not perpetuate themselves very well. But the Quakers remain in the forefront of most of the what we would think of as liberal causes. They are the first to establish an Indian Rights Association. They work with Indians. They try and get a better deal for Indians. They are the leading abolitionists. They lead the women's suffrage campaigns of the 1830s, 40s, 50s, and onward. They lead penal reform, reform of the insane asylums, and of course they are leading the peace movement. So they are out there on the very progressive to radical edge of American reform, more so than being involved in these utopian communities.
When we take all these various visions that you write about in the Unknown American Revolution, the tradesmen, the farmers, women, Native Americans, African Americans, and we take all these visions and start to look at them and start to think about the meaning of the American Revolution, what are the lessons for us today?
Well, one lesson is that when you step forward to write on a blank sheet, you have to be prepared to persevere, carry on the struggle, be patient, but not expect immediate results. So we can take through the eyes of those who wanted the sharpest changes in American society. If we take the short-term view, we would say they were mostly disappointed. If we take a longer view at it, however, I think we see that they made their mark. They left marks on the blank sheet that people would go back to generation after generation, push the same agendas, work for them, and today most of these have been accomplished.
Can America be happy?
Can America be happy?
Yeah.
Well, America is certainly happier today for the radicals of the revolutionary period and the agendas that they put down.
There we have to leave it. We're out of time. Professor Nash, thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon.
Well, thank you for having me on your program. I enjoyed it.
My pleasure. Historian Gary Nash, his latest book is The Unknown American Revolution, The Unruly Birth of Democracy, and The Struggle to Create America. The book is published by Viking. 9 minutes before 2 o'clock, settlement prices are in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Dave Dickey.
Thank you, Celeste, and good afternoon, everyone. The gains that the soy pit saw early in the trading session were given back for the most part by the close, and we did see a slightly higher close in beans across the complex. However, we did see down days in the wheat and corn pits. We'll discuss today's action in just a few minutes with Wayne Nelson of L&M Commodities in Newmarket, Indiana. That, of course, on the closing market report, which gets underway at 2:06. Let's go ahead and get you caught up with the settlement prices. And as we always do, we start in the wheat pit. September, a high on the day of 324.5, a low of 316.25, settling 317.25, down 5.75. A lot of selling on the funds on late in the day in the wheat pit. December, a high on the day of 338.5, a low of 330.75, settling 331.5, down 5.25. March, a high of 350, a low of 343.5, settling 344.5, down 4.75. May, a high of 355, a low of 350, settling on its low, down 5. July, a high of 358.25, a low of 352.5, settling 352.75, down 3.75. And the action in the wheat pit probably contributed to the lack of upside momentum in the corn pit as it tried to gain into a gap around the 228 level. Couldn't completely fill the gap, fell back on the day. September corn, a high of 215, a low of 210, settling 210.5, down 2. December, a high of 228.5, settling 223.5, settling 224, down 2. March, a high of 238, settling 232.75. For the low there, then the settlement 233.5, down 1.75. The May contract, a high of 243.25, a low of 238.5, settling 239, down 2. The red line July, a high of 248, the low 243.5, settling 243.75, down 2. In September, a high of 250, a low of 247, settling on its low, down 1.5 on the day. September oats, a high of 152, a low of 150, settling on its low, up 1. December, a high of 161, a low of 158.25, settling 159, up 3/4. September soybeans, a high of 615.5, a low of 605.5, settling 610.75, up 3.5. November, a high of 626, a low of 614.5, settling 620.5, up 3.25. January, a high of 632, a low of 621.5, settling 626, up 2.5. March, a high of 636, a low of 626, settling 631, up 1.75. May, a high of 639, a low of 628.5, settling 632.5, up 2.75. The July beans, a high of 641, a low of 632, settling 636.5, up 1.5. September soybean meal, a high of 193.20, a low of 189.10, settling 190, up 10. October, a high of 193.30, a low of 189.20, settling 190.50, up 60. September soybean oil, a high of 22.69, a low of 22.38, settling 22.56, up 13. The October contract, a high of 22.79, a low of 22.50, settling 22.66, also up 13 on the day. A reminder that we will be out at the Tri-County High School Auditorium in Wolcott, Indiana, this evening at 6:30 for another one of our free AM 580 Agricultural Outlook meetings. It's east off I-65. Take the Remington exit, and you head east until you run into Wolcott, and that's where we'll be. Panelists for tonight's meeting include Purdue University Ag Economist Chris Hurt, Mike Zuzel of Risk Management Commodities, and Wayne Nelson of L&M Commodities. Get your agricultural questions answered. No charge. Come on out. Dry County High School Auditorium in Wolcott tonight at 6:30. In the studio now, with a look at today's prices from the Chicago Mercantile Exchange is Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, Dave. It was a mostly lower day today for livestock prices on the Merc. August feeder cattle, 111.30, the high, 110.80, the low, 111.15, the settlement. That finished up 47 and a half. September, 109.70, the high, 109.07 and a half, the low. The settlement, 109.15, that down 2 and a half. October live cattle, 108.65, the high, 107.75, the low, 107.85, the settlement, that unchanged. August live cattle, 81.25, the high, 80.30, the low, 80.55, the settlement, that up 30. October live cattle, 82.40, the high, 81.45, the low, 81.62.5, the settlement, that down 17.5. October lean hog, 62.80, the high, 61.40, the low, 61.67.5, the settlement, that down 75. December, 60.50, the high, 59.40, the low, finishing at 59.57.5, that down 82.5. February, 60.95, the high, 60.40, the low, 60.72.5, the settlement, that down 25. And April lean hogs, 60.50, the high, 59.65, the low, finishing at 60.35, that up 15. August pork belly, 71.25, the high, 69.35, the low, 69.75, the settlement, that down 160. The Dow is off 25 points at 10,545. The NASDAQ up 1 at 21.43. The S&P 500 down 2 at 1220.
Support for today's broadcast comes from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods. Now through Labor Day, World Harvest is featuring Welcome Back Food Tastings for returning students, faculty, and residents Monday through Friday along with their Saturday tasting. Also, they've expanded their line of Turkish foods and delicacies. World Harvest Foods at the intersection of 6th and University, Champaign.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Mai McAllister from Harrison, Michigan writes, Dear Dr. Science, just who is Betty Crocker? Is she the result of some mad cloning experiment between Julia Child and the Galloping Gourmet?
Imagine a midnight tryst between Betty Crocker, Mrs. Butterworth, and Aunt Jemima. I mean, I know they all seem to be women, but that's the operative word, seem. Things are always not as they seem to be. Sometimes it takes a real man to get the pot boiling. And that's where Clint Eastwood came in. Yeah, the wooden actor is actually as accomplished in the kitchen as he is in the saddle or on the soundstage. Don't even bother to ask what he had going with Martha Stewart. By the way, I hear she's not all she seems to be either.
Thank you, Dr. Science. Send your science questions to Ask Dr. Science. Remember, he's not a real doctor.
I have a master's degree.